This is January 10th, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or of any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me, in the studio with me, is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek. Hi.
Oh, hi there.
And Mr. Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
So, geeks, on this show, for years, Miles, we've been saying, oh, OS X, Macintosh, it's so much easier and better. And, you know, you don't get viruses. We kind of laugh about it. But the truth is, we've kind of said over and over, it's safe. Generally it's safe. I mean, there's examples of applications out there that take advantage of a user's choice normally and that can, you know, break security and install something bad. But typically, it hasn't been the kind of level of complexity or badness, if you will, that exists in the Windows sphere.
Yeah.
So we're safe when we're using a Mac.
Not anymore.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah. Yay.
The first confirmed OS X boot kit has been announced.
What be a boot kit, Miles?
Okay, so we've talked about rootkits before. Those are things that patch the operating system at the base level so you can't detect it. And it's
a lot of viruses do this, right? They modify the operating system itself.
And so I don't then know the operating about a lot system, of them, but there are a lot out
so
there.
Then the operating system starts lying to you, right? And that gets real difficult. The only thing you can do is erase the whole hard drive and install the operating system from fresh.
Right, which would work. Yeah. It won't work with this. And this actually comes into play because the Apple hardware is so homogenous. The fact that there is now an exploit that goes in and rewrites part of the Mac firmware.
The thing that shouldn't be rewritable, exactly.
Right. This is before
the BIOS. Yeah, this is what you're talking
before
about.
Before the operating system has loaded. Which means that even if you wipe the system and reinstall, the operating system could still possibly get bad information from the system firmware,
right,
and you'd still be compromised.
Now, in traditional computers, like what I learned on in school, the actual ROM, the hardware level storage that is the boot of the application of the computer, was a physical chip you could pull out of the board, and then you could put another one in. And in fact, it had a window on the front of it, and you could erase it with a flash ROM. So this is a technology
for EEPROMs, yeah.
Right? EEPROMs, you could flash them, erasing them, and then put your own boot on it. And that's basically how you'd modify the core of the computer. In fact, sometimes you see a situation where people modify some parts of the boot sector by updating it. But traditionally, you have to have some kind of other access to the machine.
Right. And you still need physical access to the Mac in order to make this exploit.
But you don't need to open up
the case. You don't need to pull a chip out or unsolder it and solder it back in, which was the case with others. What you have to do is I don't mean to laugh about this, but when you're first booting up, you have a USB device in there, and so you are able to overwrite.
Wait, but I thought this was only a Thunderbolt thing, not a USB thing.
Well, Thunderbolt, okay, you're right.
Because Thunderbolt and FireWire both have access to a core level of the operating system, the memory.
Right. You plug in the Thunderbolt
device, connector.
Yes.
Yeah. The Thunderbolt bus actually is the issue.
Right, and as you boot up the computer, or actually, no, while the computer is still on, you're able to do this.
Yes,
so take
yes,
that back.
You can do this, right.
And you're able to overwrite those sectors. And the thing is, even if your system is locked, like you have a screensaver lock or whatever that asks for your password, the person can just hold the power button, turn the Mac off, and then turn it on
and start doing it on boot.
And basically the rules that say make sure that a user has a password and unencrypted, all that, you just can modify those rules.
Right. And even if the hard drive is encrypted.
Right. This is great.
Because this happens before anything happens
now,
with the drive.
The point being here, if your hard drive is encrypted, the data is totally safe. Until someone modifies the operating system, modifies the hardware, then you log in the next time, that hardware modification is just storing your password locally, and then you're fully accessible. Basically, you can imagine it's instead of the operating system being modified, it's the hardware being modified. There's nothing you can do about it. And all you have to do is have access to the machine.
That's all a hacker has to do is have access to your machine.
That is actually why I don't think it's an extremely dangerous thing. And the reason I say this is because Traditionally, the reason why viruses spread so much is that they kind of leap through networks. And that effect is the reason why they spread and you get infected and it's easy, right? You get an email link and then you get infected. That hasn't happened in the Macintosh environment very much. This vulnerability still doesn't allow for that because somebody has to have access to it physically.
Right. However, if – and maybe I'm just taking this personally. Yes. If you work for a company like Google or Netflix or Yahoo or any of those others that – or Facebook that have a – where you have access to some systems – you become a target, and that means that someone who knows, like, here's this pool of people that that have this access, I'm going to target one of them, get access to them. That person may not even know that their hardware is compromised.
So the point, though, that this vulnerability is mostly for targeted people. The problem is a lot of people could be a targeted person. And additionally, if you went and bought a computer off eBay, there's no reason not to think that somebody did this. There's no way to detect it.
Right, and there's no reason to believe that this would be limited to companies. This could also be to governments.
Yes.
This could also be to people who have access to facilities. You know,
so first OS X bootkit revealed. It's based off the Thunderbolt line. Thunderbolt has the same power and vulnerability as the FireWire line.
Chances are, if you're not a very important person within, say, the government or tech or something like that, this isn't going to happen to you. But if you are an important person, just continue to be as good and diligent about security as you.
I wouldn't be surprised if companies start modifying the Thunderbolt ports so that you can't access them easily. You know, fill them with solder.
I wait with bated breath for Apple to make a patch for this.
Absolutely. Hey, let's do some wearable tech. CES was happening. A lot of wearable announcements happened. And Ben, I noticed that actually you are wearing a computer on your wrist. You haven't before. What the heck are you doing?
This is the first time ever that I've worn a wearable, aside from your Google Glass, I think.
Which you didn't. Yeah, in fact, Google Glass right now, this is my third one that's died. I'm going to get my fourth one soon.
Oh,
in the mail.
No.
But I haven't bought them. They just part of the plan.
Yeah, you look naked without a Google Glass on your face.
But you look surprisingly handsome with that watch on your
wrist. Thank you so much. Yes. Oh, well, just to be clear, this is not something out of CES. This is a Pebble watch, which was one of the gifts for the Reading Rainbow Kickstarter, which you may or may not remember from back in, I think, June last year.
Yes, sure. Yeah. LeVar Burton, who did Reading Rainbow years ago when
and
I grew
Star
up
Trek,
on television.
Notably.
And, of course, Geordi LaForge on Star Trek, blind navigator and then head engineer. Very interesting. Anyway, he...
The head engineer. Well, not the engineer of heads, but the...
Oh, my God.
Chief engineer. That's it.
I thought Miles had a pedantic rule. Anyway, he launched a Kickstarter to relaunch Reading Rainbow. And you announced it here on GeekSpeak, I believe. And did you participate in that?
Yeah, I did. I got a Pebble watch as my gift for donating.
So you put enough money to get a Pebble watch?
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah. But the only problem is I bought the Pebble. I donated and, you know, got the Pebble watch reward and everything like 7 months after I made the contribution to the Kickstarter.
Sure.
So I've been waiting for this Pebble watch and, you know, should be shipped in December.
Was it special compared to other Pebble watches?
Well, it does. It kind of looks like 90s tech.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's kind of clunky and everything. I don't mind.
To me, it looks like those watches that had the calculator on them. I used to wear one of those. It's a little bigger.
It's got my calendar on it and it vibrates whenever I have to make a turn on navigation.
But unlike many watches, you don't have to charge it every day.
And unlike many watches, aside from probably about 200 in the world, it has LeVar Burton's signature on the back.
Woo-hoo. Ooh, that's cool. What did he sign it with? A silver pen or is it etched?
With his name.
Be careful. Your skin might erode his signature and make it...
You know, I'm actually surprised it's still there.
You've been wearing it for 24 hours, Ben.
Yeah, I know.
You're not that much of a workout person. Anyway, cool. And Pebble Watch, you'll keep a surprise. Does it make sense to have a little computer on your wrist? And then we'll compare it to Google Glass in general. You don't look as stupid as I do with Google Glass on, so there's that at least.
I can tell you right now, I don't know. It's worth it if you want to have a computer on your wrist. I don't know. We'll see if I'm still wearing it in 6 months.
All right.
I'm enjoying it today because it's...
Let's keep the theme going of wearable technology. Miles, you got one for this?
Yes. The Los Angeles Police Department is ordering that the body cams that they've been instituting for the officers to wear...
Body cam means a camera that films everything the officer sees, basically.
Will start recording automatically when the police use their tasers.
Okay.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about this.
You get tased and then it starts recording?
basically, as soon
as you
hit
the trigger,
officer
tases somebody or fires the taser, and that's how they start recording.
What?
Why not? So we're going to have all this video of people shaking on the ground violently?
Right, exactly. For a long time, tech has been out there to do a constant loop recording. And then if you, whenever you hit a button or whatever, it says, oh, I'm going to start from 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And then continue on through and keep all of that data. Or I'm going to keep the last section that I've already recorded. That's what I'm interested in knowing about. Not after you've already been hit by after the situation has already escalated. Mm-hmm. And Lyle, in the green room, you actually brought up a very good point with regard to tasers versus the other means that they have.
Yeah, it seems to me that if you know as a police officer that any time you pull the trigger of the taser, you'd start having a recorded copy of what's going on, you might pull the baton out instead of the taser, or the gun instead of the taser. Like, it could modify...
Or your bare hands.
Or your bare hands. Like, you could do things that weren't potentially the right thing to do based off of what's recording is going to happen.
Right. It's thinking like how much storage space video takes.
That's the thing is, you could have everybody record 24 hours a day. It's not a big deal. It's like... Who cares?
Well, I wonder about the battery time on the camera. At the same time, considering how much other things weigh, like
I know you definitely could have a video camera that goes, or even a video camera that goes in a 1 hour loop, right? And anytime some event happens, anytime you file anything, anytime you etc., you're supposed to say, yeah, that hour is important, so that you don't get driving around the streets for days and days and days, right? But the other thing is, anytime a police officer gets out of their car, that's when you can say, okay, from when they started driving when they slowed the vehicle down to when they got out of the car, we're recording. That seems like a fine thing to do too. Like, there's so many better ways to do this.
Take care of the other portions, and then when the cop gets out of the car, that's when it goes off. Yeah.
The thing that's important to note is that from a technical perspective, it would be easy to say every time you fire the taser, keep the extra hour before this, and keep going. Like, the pre-recorded loop being cached and saved is easy to implement. So it's really frustrating to see that's the decision they came down to. I'd like police officers to wear a video camera every time they're on duty. It makes no sense not to. Anyway.
Well, it makes no sense to you. It makes sense to others not to have that. But, but what concerns me is the expense that's being put into this for something that it's like, if you're going to spend the money where it encompasses all of the problem rather than spending a whole bunch of money for, you know, not really addressing the problem at hand.
Right. So, Ben, let's do another story before our break. Just think fun, please.
All right. Do you happen to know how to play Texas Hold'em?
Oh, you bet. I like that. It's a poker derivative, and the general rules are that you get some cards in your hand and some cards get face down. And
so you don't know all the cards that
right. So you
pertain
get
to your hand.
You get a set of cards like poker, traditional set of cards, but some of them turn face up and everybody gets to see them. So you have more insight to what other people have. And based on what's on the table, but you have some hidden stuff in your hand, you can bet effectively because you know the other person what they might have. So it's there's a lot more knowledge, but a lot less guessing about it.
Yeah, well, so you just explained the game to me. There are some other people who don't actually play the game. They're computer scientists at the University of Alberta, and they don't really play this game, but they did solve it. So what they did is they went through every single permutation of this game. So they brute force it. There are 3 × 10⁻¹⁴ possible decisions that can be made.
How many?
300 trillion possible.
I'm assuming they set the amount of player count to like 4, and that's how many it was. Because the game could also be played with more people and more cards. So they probably have a limited set, and that's a lot.
That's also probably more hands of poker than have ever been played ever.
Yeah, right.
In the world.
No, this is numbers that are big.
Yeah. So, so basically, they made a massive, massive table and figured out. By the way, the table is 11 terabytes of data. So this is a 11 terabyte table of all of the different situations that a player could be in and what to do.
Interesting. Just from the knowledge they have.
Just from the knowledge. So basically, Cepheus, is that how you say it, Miles?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Cepheus. Good. I said it right.
Actually, I have no idea how to say it. So
that's the name of the computer program that these people
have written.
Alberta wrote. And it will not lose. because it literally plays a perfect game, the most perfect game anyone could ever play in every circumstance.
Okay. Now, first off, there is chance involved in this.
There is.
And there's some things you can't know, and therefore it wouldn't necessarily always win, but it would do the best job it possibly could, that you physically possibly could do.
So basically, if you sit down and play one hand with this computer program and you manage to come out ahead, stop right there. Like, really. Probabilistically, you will lose money, and much more quickly than you'd lose money playing any human on the planet.
Awesome. This kind of advice and more coming up in just a second.
Don't gamble, kids.
Don't gamble with computers, kids. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KOSP, and they're with me as Miles Elaman, Ben Jaffe. Hey, next time on the 7th Avenue Project, up-and-coming comedian Nori Davis finds the funny in some of life's most delicate situations. He talks to KOSP's Robert Pauly about getting bailed out of jail by his policeman father, his family's reaction to his transgender brother, making fun of homophobia, and why there are no good slurs for white people. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking People's Radio, Sunday at noon here on 88.9 KOSP. You are listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Mr. Miles Elam and Mr. Ben Jaffe. And Ben, you're not just doing this podcast anymore.
I know. That's true. I have another podcast that I started with a friend of mine, Katie, and she and I talk about machine learning and data science. So my day job, I work at a company called Udacity, and I teach computer science courses specifically in the web development track. And Udacity also has a data science track. And so there are some really fantastic data science people at that company that I get to talk to every day, and I get to learn all about machine learning and data science. And at one point I thought, hey, this is really cool. I should turn this into a podcast so other people can learn what I'm learning. So if you want to listen, you could go to geekspeak.org and click on the link, or you can go to lineardigressions.com. That's the name of the show, Linear Digressions.
Congratulations. I've heard your inaugural episode, maybe half another episode. It's quite good. It has more about topic-based stuff than Geek Speak, but definitely has your same flavor of good content. So I highly recommend it. And you can get to it from today's episode of Geek Speak and all the things we talk about. Chandler is live updating the website, so if you go up there, you'll see that you've got to refresh it every once in a while to see the content change. But basically, as we go, content being added to geekspeak.org.
Also, I just have to say, machine learning is so, so cool. I didn't know really much about it at all before I started working at Udacity and doing this podcast. It is so cool, and there's so many cool things that you can do with it. Bill Gates actually said about machine learning, quote, a breakthrough in machine learning would be worth 10 Microsofts. Like, there's an incredible promise here, and it's basically throwing problems at computers, and instead of telling them how to solve it, they figure out how to solve it.
That's right.
Really cool.
Okay, CES, the formerly named Consumer Electronics Show, now just CES.
They de-acronymified their acronym.
But it's a Consumer Electronics Show. I mean, it's all electronics about consumers, right?
That's weird.
So a couple things that got revealed and shown. Printing pizzas. Yes, this year you'll be able to buy a printer, and it will be able to print pizzas that you can eat in your home. It's only $7,000 or so, and of course you have to fill it with liquid goo that represents food material.
And you have to clean it.
And you have to clean it
after every use.
It's completely silly. But it does do really interesting jobs on decorative patterns of chocolate, right? So I could definitely see this being used in a cake shop where you want to put people's names on the top of a cake with chocolate. You can just have the printer print it. So in some regards, it could be some cool features. And it actually is injecting the food substance itself with a little, like, I don't know, a big syringe from the top. All right. And USB-C, people
seems
play with it.
Weird to me.
Yeah.
I don't really want my food prepared that way.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is proof of concept.
Well, I mean, it's edible. But then a lot of things are edible that you shouldn't eat.
It's a proof of concept.
I don't know, I'd rather eat that than most TV dinners that are out there.
Yeah. But you can't print your TV dinners.
Actually, technically speaking, a lot of those TV dinners are
injected stuff. Yeah, exactly. The other thing that happened on CES is people got to play with the new USB port type. And that's the port type C. And this is a...
So there's USB 2.1, 2.0, 3.0,
C? The numbers don't have to do with the connectors. So USB has a protocol number, which will work on different types of connectors. And the connectors are A and B, which are the traditional ones you saw, that they're kind of a long rectangle on the size of your laptop, and then the square one, which is an older peripherals.
That's A is the square one, right?
I can't remember which is which. And then there's the micro and the mini, and those are the two types you've also seen. Your Android phone uses a mini. The micro has a kind of different shape to it. Anyway, this
Android
replaces...
Android phone is usually the... Yeah, it's the
mini.
The micro, actually.
The micro.
Yeah, the micro.
Is the usually okay. For other devices.
And like then there are all these other... weird yeah. ones that
so,
no one talks about.
The mini one on the Android devices, the thing that's interesting about USB so far is it's always had a directional polarity. You had to plug it in one way. And mm-hmm. if you look at your USB ports and you feel like you've tried to plug it in, then you've got to flip it over, that frustration, they're getting rid of that with the C connector. It will be universal. You can flip it either direction. But as I've said on Geekspeak before, I think the design of this is pretty faulty. We're going to see some potential problems in the early stages. They have a lot of complexity in the connector head. It's not like the Lightning where the physical is really simple, but the smarts are inside in the cable with mm-hmm. electronic device. Instead, the USB-C, the physical is complicated. There's a lot of pins, and the breakout board, you can tell there's tons of pins on both sides. Mm-hmm. They're duplicating. They're delicate. We'll see how it goes.
It also coincides with USB 3.1.
That's right.
Coming out.
That's the thing that's important about this. This is currently will support all the speeds of USB, which is kind of nice.
And a new 3.1 is not – I mean, 3.0 is 5 gigabits per second. 3.1 is 10.
Yeah.
So
not bad.
I have a question for you two. Maybe you know the answer. Why did we go from 1.1 from 1.0 to 1.1 to 2.0 to 3.0 to 3.1? Like, what's when do we jump 0.1
standard,
and when do we jump 1?
It's just how standards bodies are okay. going to do things.
It's nothing
theoretically,
to do with the speed or
well,
something.
Theoretically, everything that could all the physical hardware that could support 3 could also support 3.1. So
okay.
you'd need like a breaking backwards compatibility issue.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
So if you break backwards compatibility, then you definitely jump up an integer.
I think that's the general rule. There's a whole rule set on versioning, and I know it in software, but I don't know it so well in hardware. But anyway,
cool.
Let's move on. So another CES announcement, Miles?
So I'm sorry, catching up here.
oh, so the one I was talking about
drives.
Yeah.
So we've talked about faster speeds for interconnections, which is USB, but there's also SSD drives. When you're working on eSATA or SATA, they go up to 6 gigabits a second, so 540 megabytes a second. So we need to go faster than that. And so things have moved forward to PCIe bus, and they'll get up into the 700 megabytes a second. And like, well, Samsung just unveiled the first PCIe 3.0 times 4 M.2 SSD, if that's enough acronym word soup for you.
What does it mean? What does it mean, sir?
What it means is that this little device, and when I'm talking little, I mean it's little, a stick
of gum?
Yeah, of mm-hmm. spearmint gum type okay. of thing, will go about 1.6 gigabytes per second.
Okay.
Actually, no, I take that back. Speed of 2.1 gigabytes per second.
Wow. Very cool.
In other words, four times faster than the fastest solid-state device that typically fits into a laptop.
So now with this, the new motherboard can – Samsung's thing allows an extension of an SSD drive, a solid-state drive, to have four times the speed of traditional SSD drive or current-day SSD drives.
Actually, a by-four would allow for faster speeds than that, but I think it's just as fast as this device can go.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. All right.
Awesome. Now the drawback.
Yeah.
Yeah,
power.
There really aren't any motherboards out there that can handle this device yet. So, well,
it's fine, but
we'll
the processor
wait,
can't
but,
handle it. The memory right. can't handle it. Nothing else can handle it.
Yeah, but we will start seeing them very soon. 2015, you will start seeing motherboards that will
yeah.
handle this.
And basically, it's because the PCIe, the board type, the connection type, the backbone type of the bus, you can actually have them run. You can have run multiple buses on it, and this is a four times that bus, and that's how it does the massive speed.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean the processor has the interconnect to actually access that all at once. So anyway,
right. unlike hard drives, where to get them faster, you really needed to spin the platter faster,
yeah.
type of thing. This is the type of thing that could find its way into laptops.
Yeah,
there's no
Sweet.
Reason why you couldn't have the power.
Okay, one more revelation about CES, really quick. And this is kind of cool because we've covered before that Tesla is kind of pushing some boundaries. One of the things that Tesla Corporation, the car company, did is they made all of their patents for electric cars available for everybody to use, called royalty-free, basically inviting other manufacturers to use their tech.
Yeah, some months ago.
Yeah, some months ago. And we're seeing that kind of be a viable way of lifting up a technology platform. Tesla's put a whole bunch of energy into it. They're making it. Well, so now Toyota's basically copying them. Toyota is doing, for their hydrogen technology, they're offering over 5,000 patents, including pending patents, available to 2020, so 5 more years, royalty-free, which is really cool because it allows for other car companies to just kind of jump on top of the hydrogen technology that they've done. Now, they have them set into 3 different pools of patents: the fuel cell stack, the high-pressure tanks for holding hydrogen safely, and the system control system. And all those patents will be available for a period of time, royalty-free. Of course, at the end of that royalty-free, will they charge? Who knows? And then the other thing that's kind of interesting is that they're saying all the patents they have for their fuel service stations, where you actually pump hydrogen, compressed hydrogen, into a compressed tank in your vehicle, they're making those patents free indefinitely, or royalty free for indefinitely. They've got like 70 of those. So they're trying to make that whole hydrogen economy work.
This is a nice switchover because, unfortunately, with the dropping of gas prices, you know, great for whenever I go to the pump, but they've also coincided with people buying a lot more gas guzzlers.
Yep.
And putting them on the road. Americans have very short memories.
Wait, haven't the gas prices gone up yet? It's January, so they should be going up pretty soon, right away.
They're
gas guzzling drivers over there, you let me know when the prices go up, because I have an electric vehicle. I don't use gas. Anyway,
so anything that encourages wider adoption and lower prices for alternative technologies is always a win.
Absolutely. Okay, off of CES, let's talk about some more fun, I don't know, some engineering issues.
Oh, I was going to talk about football, something I know very, very little about.
Okay.
But actually, this ties into something I do know a bit about, which is seismography. So as it turns out, back on January 8th, 2011, football fans will probably remember Marshawn Lynch made a touchdown run and the crowd went wild and everyone started jumping up and down in the stadiums. And a block away, there was a seismograph. That's the device that detects earthquakes. And they noticed this blip, all of this noise on the seismograph. And it was because a block away, people were jumping up and down and shaking the earth. And actually, you could actually pick that up a block away on a seismograph. So that got some researchers interested from the University of Washington. So they installed last year some instruments in the stadium and around the stadium and actually set up a website so that way you could watch the seismograph data come in near real time, and you'd actually be able to see when someone made a play because everyone started jumping up and down.
So what? How big of an earthquake was this? From a Richter scale kind of perspective.
I don't know the Richter scale number, but okay. It's tiny, but detectable, and that's I guess the point. So what they're actually doing research on?
I was actually thinking easily detectable because if you're standing in a stadium, you feel everything shake as stuff's going on.
Yeah, but I mean, how much are you shaking the earth, and how much are you shaking?
See, it sounds
just
like
a stadium.
The reason why I led into this is an engineering problem. It sounds like they've got to engineer stadiums to have cushioning systems such that they don't radiate, excessive physical disturbances outside of their environment. But maybe that's more expensive.
Crazy. I don't know. But anyway, so the reason that they're doing this is not just for funsies. They're doing it because they're trying to get information on they're trying to develop technologies for an early warning earthquake system. So as many of us know, seismic waves, the earth actually shaking, travels at a particular speed. Light travels way, way, way faster. Electrons going down a wire travels way faster. So if there's an earthquake detected right near the epicenter of the earthquake, if you could actually get a signal out quick enough, you could have an early warning system for people further away, and then let them know an earthquake's about to hit, and then they can, because it's on its way, and they can get under something or whatever.
Cool. All right. Thanks.
So what they're doing this year is they've set up this website and they've gotten the latency down to about 3 seconds to being published on a website. So Seahawks fans can actually be watching the 10-second delay thing on their television and be watching this website, and they'll know when to watch the television because they'll see this big disturbance on the seismograph.
Okay, that's kind of cool. Like a little bit of warning so you don't miss the play.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Okay, I'll go with that.
It's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool. I'm not into sports, so
I'm not into sports either, but my hope is that these researchers will be able to, springboard off of, all this media attention and also the data that they're going to get.
All right. Miles, you mentioned that Apple hardware has a security vulnerability, but there's also some privacy concerns that Apple announced recently.
Yeah, Yosemite's had some problems coming. The most recent version of the OS X operating system.
Sounds like a bad day to work at Apple, or a bad week.
Yeah.
In security.
Previously on the show, we had coverage where if you had made some searches for stuff on the system, it would send those search queries up to Apple servers to be able to look up Wikipedia entries and the like.
It was a privacy concern. That was Tesla's High Pressure Ads Fall from Space was the name of that episode, and that was our October 25th episode of 2014. We'll have it linked to today's show.
This one is quite different. This one has to do with Apple Mail. One of the concerns about email in general is that many times people who are less scrupulous will put images into an email, into HTML email. And when this concept was first brought up, what would happen is that image would be downloaded by people who actively had email accounts. And so that spam or whatever would be able to uniquely identify the person and know that they were getting the email messages that were being sent out. It was a marketer's dream. At the same time, it had some very serious privacy implications. So many email clients would turn that feature off. They would not download images that were not intrinsically part of the message but were outside resources unless you specifically turned it on.
Okay.
And some people have turned it on. It's up to you whether you want to do that. It's that whole prettiness and convenience versus privacy and security conversation. But what happened here is that when you go into Spotlight and you're searching for something and it goes through your mail and looks for an item, even if you have the option turned off to automatically download images, it will download the image and show that in the preview for your Spotlight results.
Oh, not good.
Which means it bypasses that privacy safeguard.
Yeah, not a good thing. Okay, so what can you do regarding this, though?
Currently, you can't do anything. You have to go to you have to wait for Apple to fix that.
What if you disable Spotlight completely or not use Spotlight? It's still going to do it. Because,
well, that would work. Yeah. I mean, if you, you
Spotlight,
turn it off
of course,
completely, then
Spotlight
well.
Of course is a feature in OS X that's been around for a while. You hit the Command key next to the space bar and the space bar. You hit them in next to each other at the same time, and you get a little prompt of search, and you start searching, and it kind of gives you results. That's where we're talking about this vulnerability exists. It's a convenience factor, and we always know that convenience and privacy and security have this crazy relationship.
I'm sorry, I take that back. There is a way to mitigate this.
Good.
Correcting myself here.
Real time update.
Yes. If you go into System Preferences for Spotlight, and there are options for what shows up in Spotlight, you can turn off mail and messages. The problem is you don't get to search through your email anymore, so there is a drawback to it, but you don't get various data sent to spammers.
Which is always a good thing, mostly. All right, Ben, we've got one. Thank you, Miles. Ben, you've got 1 second to this next story.
We'll be getting an extra leap second in June.
What is a leap second, Ben?
You told me I just had 1 second.
Darn it! We'll be right back to explain all that and more here on GeekSpeak. You're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxel. This is KUSP 889 FM. Miles Elam's in the air with me and Mr. Ben Jaffe as well. And Ben, I asked you about your next story. You had to do it quick. It was a leap second. What is a leap second?
A leap second is an extra second to be added to clocks to compensate for discrepancies between our time system
and the universe
and the movement of the Earth.
Okay. So
because our time system is weird. It doesn't make any – I mean it's arbitrary. It's fitting – an arbitrary number of seconds into minutes, into hours, into days, into years, based on the orbit of the Earth and the rotation of the Earth.
And we like to have years correspond to the amount of time it takes to circle the Earth.
Yeah, we like that a lot.
And we like the idea of having the amount of time of a day of 24 hours being one rotation of the Earth. And unfortunately, those two things don't actually perfectly correlate to make a perfect time system.
Yeah, we have.
Who knows, because of leap years.
365.25007 something something or something like that. That's how many days there are in a year. And so every 4 years, we get an extra leap year, except for every 100 years, which we don't, and then every 400 years, we do. I always forget the rules.
Okay, what programmers here have implemented it? I've implemented that once, but you don't have to do it yourself.
Good for you, yeah.
Well, I didn't account for the leap second, though.
So. Usually, yeah. Well, so there are problems, actually, with leap seconds, because if software developers are using software that doesn't take that into account, then that can be disruptive to any systems that need to be precise. So navigation systems, communication systems, any of that.
So why didn't developers write in code to be able to handle this leap second 10 years ago?
Oh, because we didn't know there was going to be a leap second 10 years ago, because the standards organizations, I mean, they
bunted on it.
I don't know exactly the story behind this particular second.
Right.
We've already spent a minute on it.
No, we spent 4 minutes on it.
I do just have to say, if you're watching a clock which takes this into account properly, on June 30th at 23:59:59, that's 11:59:59, instead of clicking over to midnight, it will click over to 11:59:60.
Or
11:59:60. So, and your clock theoretically should say something that it almost never says.
Wait, when is this happening?
June 30th. Well, I'm going to be staying up till midnight.
We've got to find a clock that does this. That is fantastic.
I know.
And take a screenshot and everything about it.
So you know what you can do? Is you can go into your operating system. You can change the time right now to June 30th.
And see if your operating system will do it.
And see if it does it. And then you can set it back to auto set.
Ooh, cool.
And then
okay.
Stay
research
up late.
For the geeks.
God,
thank
we should. I should have a party.
Yeah,
the
definitely
leap
do a leap
party.
Second party. It's going to be a short party, but definitely a leap party.
What are we going to do in that 1 second?
Woo! Okay,
don't miss.
So, talking about speeds and speed and seconds and such, let's talk about how. Let's talk about data and speed. Miles,
how much
you got a story about
data
this, right?
Could you transfer in 1 second?
Oh, good question.
Excuse me. How much data can you transfer in 1 second?
No, just do the story. Don't do the calculation on that.
Sorry.
I mean, 25. Broadband, right? We're talking about megabits
just
per second,
just to
get
some background
right?
of the show, we have a set of stories that we're going to talk about.
I tried.
And then when you do a segue, sometimes you
want
to let
me
know
Miles,
what
I recall that just a moment ago, you were texting and chatting during the show on the sideline. I tried to give you enough warning. Miles. Miles, let's talk about broadband speeds now, shall we?
So the FCC, in addition to making moves to classify cable and internet providers as tier 2 common carrier,
which we like,
they are also looking to qualify the term broadband to only refer to service that is 25 megabits per second and higher.
Okay, so actually have a real term so that when they say we're selling broadband,
it needs to be fast.
It's not declared by the company that's selling it, and therefore the numbers are totally meaningless, right?
Right.
Because I could say, we provide broadband service on GeekSpeak, because there's a lot of audio traveling, and if you listen to it, you have broadband. Like, there's no definition of it. So 25 megabits per second, you can transfer, by the way, in one leap second, 25 megabits.
Yeah,
there you go.
That was my question.
I tried correlating. Is this a good value? What kind of percentage are we talking about? Is that big enough to be broadband? I always think of broadband as, like, pretty serious. Is 25 megabits per second serious?
It's a lot more serious than it is right now.
What are people calling broadband right now?
I believe.
I think 2 megabits per second people are calling broadband, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because DSL maxes out.
Oh, there we go.
Six,
right now, the current definition is 4.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So DSL fits it.
Or 4 down and 1 up.
1 up.
Right, yeah, down speed.
And
down low
speed.
They're
talking about moving it from 25 down and 3 up.
I think that's fine
so
because
still
broadband
a consumer
service,
model as opposed to a producer model.
That's fine. That makes a lot of sense. What we're talking about is if you're participating in the internet normally, you're using a lot more download speeds. You're looking at YouTubes. You're watching videos on Netflix or something like that, right? So that is a lot of download. And the request that you make up is like you send an email attachment. Maybe you upload your photos, but in general, you use a lot less uploading up bandwidth than downloading bandwidth.
Yeah.
Right, but this has to do with the amount that people are looking at YouTube videos, how you'll have a single household will have multiple video streams going at the same time because different family members are looking at different things.
Yeah.
and that can come down to, like, you can have three different streams of Netflix going on at the exact same time, or you can have, you know, all sorts
of... Or you can use the HD features and get even higher quality. Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, all sorts of things that 4 megabits was good enough for basic definition...
low quality,
you know, streaming
YouTube
video
videos.
Or from, like, Amazon Instant Video or any of the others, like something where you're looking at video, but just a single one. Yeah. And that is just not the model that we live in today. Last
week at our house, after Christmas, all the kids now have portable devices that can stream. And we did have everybody watching video on their own devices in our house, right? We have 5 family members.
Yeah,
the dog wasn't, but other than that.
Their own content.
Oh, yeah, totally their own content. Yeah. I'm a horrible father. All right, let's move on to games, because games is also something my kids do. So there's a good segue. How was that one, Miles? Ben, what's up with
very
games?
Good, very good. Archive.org just put up a massive collection of MS-DOS games.
The first operating system that widely distributed.
Uh-huh, Microsoft DOS.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, at least. And I remember these. I am actually, contrary to the jokes you usually make, I'm not as young as you joke. I do remember Microsoft DOS, and I do remember MS-DOS games.
So MS-DOS,
he's a very bright individual that remembers things in utero.
Thank you.
DOS games, I love these games, right? These are wonderful histories.
Serious nostalgia.
But I don't have a computer that can run DOS easily. So how would you actually use these games? Yeah, you can download something you can't use.
Yeah, exactly. It's like getting, I don't know, the original Mario Brothers and you don't have a console to play it, right? Well, it turns out that for many years, people have been making emulators, and there's actually an emulator that it's called EM DOSBox, and it'll actually work in your browser. So you can go to archive.org, you can browse their collection of DOS games, you can click on one, and you can play it in the browser.
Wait, so that's done in JavaScript then? Do you know? That's awesome.
Actually, I think it might be a plugin. No, never mind. It's got to be in JavaScript. I didn't install a plugin.
All right, so here's a request to everybody. Please email us your favorite DOS game that you remember. Go to send an email to geeks@geekspeak.org, and just in the title of it, just put the title of the game that you like. You don't have to put anything in the body. Just send that to us. I'd love to hear what people remember from DOS games and what they played.
Mine is
geeks@geekspeak.org. Liro?
Liro. Okay. Do you remember
that? You're not supposed to do it on air. You're supposed to send an email about it. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll do that right now.
Liro. I don't remember Liro. It sounds good. I'll look it up.
You're a worm and you fight another worm with guns, and it's really ridiculous.
All right, Miles, what's your favorite DOS game?
Star Control 2.
Yep, I knew you'd say that. Now, are you still playing that, or you were thinking about emulating
it?
Are
you still playing it?
No, I play the version that's been ported to just about every single operating system, called Urquan Masters. In fact, I play the Urquan Masters HD edition. Because people love this game so much, they've gone back and changed all of the original music to be these well-mastered MP3s and changed the graphics so they were higher
beautiful
definition. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, okay, great. I'm glad that you're playing that game, Miles.
You? Lyle?
Oh, I don't know.
You gotta have a favorite.
I don't know if I do. Zork? I mean, I'm just gonna name the famous ones. But I don't know. That's the thing, is I don't remember the titles of them. I remember playing them, and I really don't remember the titles. So that's what I'm looking forward to doing, is going to see screenshots, go, oh, I remember that game, and then playing it, right?
Zork is Greg's, and... Alex says Lands of Lore. These are
Lands
our
of Lore,
other
Alex
geeks.
Leas. And then Greg, who always titles our show for us, is Zork. And Chandler is our intern. Chandler, do you have a favorite DOS game? Here's an example of he's never played a DOS. Have you played a DOS game? Chandler's off mic, but he's saying no. Maybe this week he's got to play a DOS game. That's your homework, Chandler.
And just for the record, I used to play Lands of Lore with Alex at his house.
Nerds.
And I've gone back and looked at Lands of Lore. It was such a horrible
game. They're horrible games.
Hey, one more bit of trivia. What do you think of all of the games that are up online right now on archive.org? What do you think the top game is?
Of people playing them online?
Yes. Of people,
I don't know.
Of people viewing and of people starring.
I don't know. I haven't looked
at this. And of people commenting.
What is it?
Oregon Trail. Oregon Trail beat out 4D Prince of Persia, which beat out Oregon Trail Deluxe, which beat out Prince of Persia.
This and other things you don't care about here on GeekSpeak. That's
exciting.
Awesome. All right, maybe I got to play some games this weekend. All right, speaking of games, my kids actually are addicted to Minecraft still. They do a lot of things, build stuff in Minecraft and so on. We've talked about in the past that Minecraft is actually a Turing complete system.
Wait, and, so like what kinds of things can you build in Minecraft?
Well, so traditionally the game is about building blocks and structures and homes and things of that nature and digging into the ground. And then what they did is they added a system called Redstone traditionally. It's, I mean, people refer to it as Redstone, but it's basically an ability to send signal. When a switch gets thrown, you can do a Redstone trail on the ground, and then you have a door that then opens if the Redstone is lit up, and the switch would cause the light up. So there's enough of these switches and actions. They're kind of like a transistor, if you will, and you can trigger them that you can actually make simple AND or gates. In fact, you can make all the logic gates you possibly could want to make, and therefore it's a Turing complete computer.
So basically in a Rube Goldberg kind of way.
Absolutely a Rube Goldberg type of way.
You can make these basic parts of a computer, which then you can put those together and make bigger parts of the computer and, you know, go on and on.
So wouldn't it be neat if you actually wrote something in it? And we've seen some examples of people spending some time to create things
in Minecraft. I've got a question. Do people actually place every single block one at a time?
Because, like, that's... No, almost always, yes.
Really?
There is scripting stuff you can do to actually run things yourself.
So I remember someone made, like, a 5/6 scale model of the USS Enterprise or something like that, and they did that automatically.
No, it was a one...
That was automatically.
No. Was it?
Yeah, it was. Oh, and it wasn't
imported some of the
one
points. But keep in mind, he only imported some of the points, and then he filled it in. So it was a lot of manual work. It wasn't automated completely. I don't think it was automated at all. We'd have to refer back to that. That was the first time I heard about Minecraft. It was your story on GeekSpeak. We'll look to the link at geekspeak.org. But okay.
Wait, so what
somebody has made is a screen in Minecraft of blocks. So they basically put this giant screen up, and we're talking hundreds of blocks to print out text. If anybody's ever looked at like their alarm clock, and in the alarm clock you see that there's segments that light up. It's called a 7-segment display. Mm-hmm. It's a numeric display that can do numbers and some letters. But this is kind of like that, but instead of the segments being segments, they're pixels made of a certain type of stone. So the video, which is up at geekspeak.org, I'm hoping pretty soon, shows off this thing. It is a 5 characters by 10 characters display that you can type in. And there's a full keyboard you can jump and push the buttons on that allows you to type. And the entire thing is built by Redstone trails and switches. And we're talking hundreds and hundreds of hours to build this thing.
I feel like you're making this up. That's insane.
It's not. It's amazing. It holds 200 bytes of memory.
What? Wait, what does that mean?
It means that there are representation of memory cells that are words of 4 wide, because ASCII you can encode in 4 bits, and there is 400 of them that can store data. Yeah, that's what it means. It's like, it's crazy. You got to see the video because it's the best way to describe it. If you know Minecraft, watch the video. It's up at geekspeak.org and you'll have a blast.
That is ridiculous. I know what I'm doing in 5 minutes after the show. Oh my God.
Wait, how do you encode ASCII in 4 bits?
Well, that's what they said, but
4 bits is 16.
Yeah.
2 to the 4 is 16.
Oh, yeah, I said that'd be more. So it's 4 bit. I don't know. I didn't look at the system. I was reading the notes. I'd have to count the bus length. It looks like, though, his display is connected serially, which is really interesting to me. So I'm not sure how he's doing that. That's pretty impressive.
I don't even understand.
I think it's time to backwards decode the YouTube.
See, like, I've seen video. Rube Goldberg machines and crazy domino trails. This is like, it sounds like this is just a crazy version of that. But
it's a bit like that.
I don't know.
Hey, Miles, there was some story about HTTPS certificates being hijacked or something on a plane. What the heck was going on?
Hijacking snakes on a plane. GoGo is – because companies or airlines don't make their own internet connection. They're going to contract out through other carriers.
Airlines. Okay. Right.
In this case, it was GoGo. And one of the things about it, though, is – and they weren't prepared for the great stylings of Chrome, the browser – is GoGo, in order to do a – what they were saying, a content filtering,
mm-hmm.
It's really hard to do content filtering when you have a secure connection, an encrypted connection like what you have with your bank and the like. And so what they had done is they had started issuing certificates – pretending to be, for example, Google.com.
So that you could go to YouTube video. So the idea here would be like if a person went to YouTube or some Google domain, they might be downloading a video and playing it. So to know if that's happening, if you're on SSL, you can't know what it is. So they instead told the airline passengers, here, accept this certificate. We're Google. And then the people had to accept it to then use the service.
So they could set up a man-in-the-middle proxy.
And then they could pretend like they're Google and they could look at all your passwords. It's a bad pattern to take. And a big reason it's a bad pattern is you don't want to train people that it's okay to accept self-signed certificates, which is what this was.
And then Chrome did flag it.
Yeah, Chrome would flag it.
Because Chrome does what's called certificate pinning. Actually, most of the major browsers do that now, where they go like, we know certain certificates, and they are in common enough usage that, and we can
know that this is not one of those ones.
And this is not Google. So it has a little broken.
Well, the other thing to note is that it wasn't signed as an authority didn't sign it. A trusted authority didn't sign it. So you'd had to accept it. The thing is, if you're forcing people to have to accept a certificate that adds added to your trusted list on your browser whenever you're on a plane, and people do that over time, if that certificate now, or even the signer of that certificate, could potentially have some pretty powerful usage outside of the airplane. So it's a really bad thing to do, the wrong way to do it. And the other thing is, it's not really necessary. Wow, we're running out of time here on Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Eleman, Ben Jaffe. Ben, quick, why doesn't the EFF like Apple Mobile?
Because Apple Mobile's terms of service are outrageous, in their own words. We'll put that up on geekspeak.org and you can read about it.
Awesome. Everything we talk about here on GeekSpeak is up at geekspeak.org right now. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use any stuff we have any way you'd like as long as you tell them who we are. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. To find out more of this episode or any episode, please do visit geekspeak.org. Don't forget, you can email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. What was your favorite DOS game? Today's theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Our intern today was Chandler. Our titler extraordinaire is Greg Merkley, and I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.